Living in a Work of Art. First published in Paradoxa in 2008, in an issue about my work, Volume 21, edited by Sylvia Kelso. The extraordinary Palace of Fine Arts near the San Francisco Marina. You can see it from the freeway to the Golden Gate. A giant orange upheld and surrounded by very large, very pensive ladies, was contributed to the San Francisco World's Fair of 1915 by the architect Bernard Maybeck. Exposition buildings weren't expected to be permanent, and Maybeck, a great experimenter with materials, built the palace out of chicken wire and plaster, or some such set of ephemeral ingredients. But it was so lovely in its utter originality, and so beloved by the people of the city, that it wasn't knocked down with the rest of the fair. When after 6 or 7 decades it finally began to crumble away, the city rebuilt it, repainting its dome the improbable gold they assure us was the original color. Born in New York, trained at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, Maybeck lived and worked in the Bay Area from 1890 till his death in 1957. His best-known buildings date from before the Second World War. He built churches, the most famous of which is the Christian Science Church in Berkeley, and at least one of his buildings for the University of California still stands, the old women's gym. But he was principally a domestic architect. The house I grew up in is known in the Maybeck canon as the Schneider House. The Schneider family lived in it 18 years. My family, the Krobers, lived in it from 1925 to my mother's death in 1979, 54 years. There are a couple of pictures of the house in the excellent book Bernard Maybeck, Artisan, Architect, Artist, by Kenneth H. Cardwell. It seems to me that while Frank Lloyd Wright remains more or less a holy idol, and various old styles such as Carpenter Gothic, Queen Anne, and arts and crafts go in and out of fashion, we haven't given much real thought for decades now to domestic architecture. Are any beautiful houses built now in any but an imitation of some older style? The high-rise apartment building, the split-level ranch, the little box development house, the McMansion in its grandiose banality reveal the poverty of our thought about buildings for people to live in. Maybeck was certainly in some ways a visionary, and his personality so marked his buildings that one can often identify a Maybeck at a glance. But he had a pre-modern understanding of the connection between dwelling place and dweller. It would be extremely silly to call a Maybeck house a machine for living. In 1908, the year after he built the house I grew up in, he wrote, "The house, after all, is only the shell, and the real interest must come from those who are to live in it. If this is done carefully and with earnestness, it will give the inmates a sense of satisfaction and rest, and will have the same power over the mind as music or poetry or any healthy activity in any kind of human experience." This consideration of the interaction of the house and its inhabitants is no less sophisticated and complex for being unfashionably modest. It asserts that the builder of the house has a relationship with the future dwellers in the house, whether he knows them or not, and that that relationship implies a responsibility towards them on the part of the architect, or so I interpret Maybeck's earnestness. We are familiar with the idea that an architect should consider the natural environs and the social setting and make his building appropriate to them. We are not as used to this idea that the house should also be appropriate to the individuals who will inhabit it. Indeed, we are not used to our architects thinking about individuals at all. Maybeck eventually would not have thought himself justified in seeing his relationship to individual inhabitants as subordinate to a theory he wished to illustrate or a statement he wished to make. I have been in Frank Lloyd Wright houses which clearly exhibit Wright's idea of architecture as self-expression. Their inhabitants have no part in them but to accept and obey the whims and mandates of the master. Maybeck's approach was quite different. Though he was as interested as Wright in the aesthetic value of the work, to him, aesthetic meaning was not a final declaration made by the architect, but the result of an ongoing dialogue between builder and dwellers. In its inhabitation, a house's beauty would be active and fulfilled. So the house I grew up in was remarkably beautiful, delightfully comfortable, and almost entirely practical. Maybeck had quirks, though, which not only make his style highly characteristic, but sometimes lend it real oddity. Our house, for example, originally had no stairs to the basement. Maybeck was moody about stairs, my mother said. She claimed that he had also left them off one of his University of California buildings, or added them outside because they didn't look right inside, or something of the sort. I wonder if it was basements that Maybeck was moody about, rather than stairs. He was a designer of joyously inventive staircases, as many houses in Berkeley still prove. The main staircase of our house was a fine rise of wide, dark steps to a landing, where it met a very narrow back flight angling up in two turns from the pantry to the landing. Straight on up from the back stairs, or a 180-degree turn on the landing, brought you to the final flight, six quite narrow steps up to the second floor. Furniture movers who had ascended the first flight with high hopes here met their doom. A fine, short, broad banister rail beside this last flight made a single but imperative statement of slant. Everything else was at right angles. Looked at from above, the short stair waterfall of the top flight broke into two, a narrow side stream angling down from the broad turn and fall of the main stair river. The loftiness of the ceiling over the landing and the complexity of the joining angles of walls and ceiling beams was a pleasure to the eye. It was literally uplifting to look at those high surfaces and high spaces, lit by the north light that came through a French door giving on a little decorative balcony at the level of the upper turn of the back stairs, which were so narrow they got triangular at the turns. If this sounds complicated, I mean it to. The whole staircase arrangement was organically complicated, like the arrangements inside a living creature. It was fascinatingly complex, yet, unlike the balcony, expressed the purest structural necessity. And it consisted entirely of redwood. Air and redwood. Light and air and redwood. And shadows. The house, with its notable beauty of material and proportion, was eminently habitable. Its proportions were human proportions. Proportion failed only at the top of the basement stairs, for a flight of steps had been installed, I think by the Schneiders, so that you wouldn't have to go outside and all the way around two sides of the house from either the front door or the kitchen door to get into the basement by its outside door. As the house was built into a hilltop slope, the ceiling over these steps was quite low, so if, standing in the tall, narrow hall at the foot of the back stairs, you flung open the door to the basement and started boldly down, you hit your head on a beam. King somebody of Scotland was killed by hitting his head on a beam. My father told us this as a solemn warning, and put marks in white paint on the lintel, which he repainted every decade or so. We all crouched when we started down to the basement. I myself grew tall enough only to scrape the top of my head occasionally on the murderous beam. But whenever I opened that door, I thought about the King of Scotland. Aside from that, I can't remember anything out of proportion or uncomfortable or unfriendly about that house. It could be terrifying at night, but I will get to that later. Even in daylight it was shadowy in places, like a forest. Maybeck speaks somewhere in his writings of dark heights, and our house had such dark heights. It was built entirely of redwood inside and out, and redwood darkens with age, but it was full of tall windows and glass-paned doors. Because the walls and ceilings and spaces were so interesting in themselves, it seemed to require little furnishing. When I was a child, we had no rugs downstairs, just the wide, bare floors, and most of our furniture was shabby, old chairs, wicker stools, a horsehair and mahogany sofa that was easier to slide off than to sit on, my mother's bed with the bullet embedded in the footboard, and so on. The dining table was one of our few elegant pieces, because it had been built with and for the house, a single broad redwood board, rather low as tables go, that sat 8 comfortably and 10 with a squeeze. It was somewhat battered, since redwood is soft and scars easily, but if you beeswaxed it diligently, it got a fine, deep glow, like a chestnut horse. There were cabinets built in corners here and there, in good arts and crafts style, some with paned glass fronts, and a seat like a window seat ran along the inner living room wall at right angles to the huge firebrick hearth and chimney. That was comfortable. So were the little stone seats built out from the hearth, where you could sit almost inside the fireplace and get really warm. Except in the few always threatened groves protected for tourists, there are no sequoias left like those from which that dining room table was cut, or with which the whole house with its great rafters and wide, long, clear boards was built. Sequoia sempervirens were common in many northern parts of California, and their wood was as commonly used for building houses. It was cheap then, and it has remarkable virtues as lumber, resistance to dry rot and weather among them. Our house in the Napa Valley, a humble, ordinary farmhouse of the 1870s, was built of redwood, painted and papered as if it were mere pine or fir. Maybeck's generation realized the extraordinary beauty of the wood and used it bare and grand. What they didn't realize was the exhaustibility of the sequoias. I don't think anyone thought much about that in 1907. None of us thought much about it till the 50s. Then, as the price of redwood went up and up, and the Save the Redwoods people fought their endless struggle against the lumber companies and the politicians, we began to look up at those wide, sweet boards and beams with a guilty, grateful awe. They were untreated, but sanded to a silken finish. Cardwell describes the color of a natural redwood interior very well. The pink tone of new lumber mellows rapidly to a rich red-brown, which is highlighted by an iridescent gold caused by the refraction of natural or incandescent light falling on the spring wood of the boards. The house was not only built throughout of redwood, but had several sequoia sempervirens planted just northwest of it. They were very large and grand by the time I first remember them. The west front stood high above the street, over a steep slope, and a double flight of stone-walled steps. The whole exterior was in the general style of a mountain chalet, with peaked roofs, deep eaves, and wooden balconies jutting out on all four sides and from both stories. The beams and struts supporting the eaves and balconies made bold diagonals against the sky and against the batten walls, the lower story with horizontal battens, the upper with vertical. This sounds ornate in words, but the simplicity of the dark wood and the massive, splendid proportions of the house itself subordinated all its roof angles and balconies to the tall, rather stern and noble whole. Decorative elements, like that tiny north balcony, kept the nobility from being either boring or overwhelming. The house both soared up from its commanding position at the top of a hill street and echoed the slope of the hills as a whole in the long western downsweep of the main roof. In every aspect, it was superbly suited and fitted to its landscape and community. It became, with the years, ever more suited and fitted to its occupants. One of the bedroom balconies, intended as a sleeping porch, was roofed and enclosed with windows to make a sunny, narrow playroom for the four children of my family. I don't know whether the Schneiders or we did that. We did a lot of things to that house. It was built for a family with only one child, Cardwell calls it, a modest house constructed on a modest budget. There were seven of us in it by 1930, and we must have been pretty crowded until my father added a wing to the east side, four rooms, two baths, two fireplaces, and a spacious attic. The attic of the original house was a dreadful dark crawl space, unusable except by black widows and bats. Nobody, I suppose, would dream of building on to a Maybeck house these days. The great man's syndrome tells us that the master's work is sacrosanct. I can only say that the wing designed by my father and his carpenter-builder, a Welshman named John Williams, fits seamlessly onto the house. No visitor I ever took round realized it wasn't part of Maybeck's original design. In proportions, the size and shape of windows, and so on, it matches the original, though without deep eaves or balconies, and without the fine details of iron latches, etc., in the William Morris style, which would have been out of fashion in the 30s, and hard to find. This large addition perfected the comfortableness of the house for us, perhaps for the children most of all. Lots of rooms, corridors to race through, space to crowd into, space to be alone in, sunny corners, an enormous attic where we set up the electric train and the armies of toy soldiers. My mother always said that women didn't like that house, and men did. I think this was one of my mother's theories. The house did have a hunting lodge quality, a certain rough, roomy starkness, which might be seen as having a virile appeal to men and not to chintz-loving women. But then, we didn't know many chintz-loving women. The women and girls I knew who knew the house loved it. The kitchen, perhaps, wasn't the modern housewife's ideal. Not many kitchens built in 1907 were. It was rather narrow, but there is convenience in being able to turn from the stove to the chopping board, to the sink, to the fridge in a few steps. It did have the one element that to me is essential in a kitchen, that is, a window over the sink. The window looked out into the north garden and the boughs of a crabapple that blossomed wonderfully in spring. There were plenty of good kitchen cabinets and drawers, and a wall of shelves to keep and display china, with sliding wood-framed glass doors from waist level up to the ceiling. Those tall doors were well made, like everything belonging to the house. They continued to slide admirably all the decades we lived there. The pantry, off the narrow hall at the foot of the back stairs, across from the King of Scotland's door, was the kind with a screened opening to the outside to keep it cool. It was a tiny dark room full of shelves, smelling of apples and old pfeffernusse and other pantry things. I would go into the pantry sometimes, just to smell it. Its smell was partly redwood. The wood is aromatic. You can't easily catch the scent in a single piece as you can in a piece of cedar or fresh-cut pine, but an enclosed space built of it has a characteristic fragrance, dearly welcome to the nose to which it smells like home. To come into our house after a long absence was to know again how immediately and profoundly the nose is connected to the emotions. Because it has nothing to do with sight or touch or hearing, the space in which smell takes place seems to me to be dark, or at least shadowy, still, and without boundaries, therefore very large, mysterious, and benign. In this it resembles the very earliest and most primitive impressions that I find in my memory of the house itself. I said above the North Garden, which sounds rather grand, and in fact the original garden must have been grand. The house stood just south of the center line of a double lot, and its steep hillside garden filled both lots. It was laid out by John McLaren, the designer of Golden Gate Park. It had a rose plot and a fountain. It was formal, as the house was not. I do not remember this garden. I can just remember some flower beds and the fountain, which didn't fount, but dripped a little. The redwoods and the ground juniper, and a pair of English yews in front of the house, a fine camphor tree south of it, a big abelia, and a couple of very William Morris weeping willows were elements of it that remained through my childhood. I don't know whether the Schneiders kept the garden up or let it go. We certainly let it go. Part of it became a badminton court, and the rest of it straggled along the way gardens of large families tend to do. I laid out acreage for my Britain's toy farm, set between the old roses, and played in the secret passages under the huge kumquat bushes, until my parents decided to build two houses on the north lot as rental properties. The crabapple tree remained in its glory, and both new houses had crowded, flowery little gardens, so our view, while washing the dishes, remained charming. The garden of our house was thus reduced to manageable size, and as we children grew up, my parents had time to potter in it, and my father planted and tended roses and dahlias, which he loved. I realize I may be causing real pain in describing the desecration of a unique Maybeck chalet and McLaren garden by an uncouth anthropologist, a Welsh carpenter, and a swarm of brats. I am sorry if this is so. It seems to me that we used both the house and the garden the best way we could. We used every inch of the house. We adapted ourselves to it, and it to ourselves. We lived in it intensely and completely. We adored it and abused it as children do their mother. It was our house, and we were its family. I think this is exactly what Maybeck had in mind when he built it. I hope so. He lived farther up the hill in one of his chicken wire houses. I have a faint recollection of a visit from him. I must have been very small, because I remember looking up at the gentle curve of his belly, and he was a very short man. It seems to me his trousers were fastened differently from other men's trousers, with a single central button placed somewhere high. But I can't get the image clear. His presence was mysterious and benign. I keep talking about comfort, practicality, and impracticality, stairs, smells, and so on, when what I want to talk about is beauty. But I don't know how to. It seems you can only describe beauty by describing something else, the way you can only see the earliest star after sunset by not looking directly at it. Surely, if you have lived in one house from birth to maturity, you're going to find the house entangled with your psyche. This may depend somewhat on gender. Women are said to identify themselves more with their house, or their house with themselves, than most men do. The old ranch house in the Napa Valley was and is extremely dear to me, as is the house in Portland I have lived in for nearly 50 years now. But the Berkeley house was fundamental. If I recall my childhood, I recall that house. It is where everything happened. It is where I happened. And the space it allowed me to happen in was truly extraordinary. That is what I am trying to talk about. It was unusually beautiful, not just pretty and pleasant, much more than that. Maybeck's artistic standard was very high. Everything around us indoors, under the scurf and scruff of children's stuff and the mess of daily living, every surface and area was nobly proportioned, handsome and generous in material and workmanship, grave, genial, and spacious. Cardwell says of the house, "Its ample feeling was developed by Maybeck's skill in relating one volume to another, as well as by his astute placement of voids in the walls that defined them. The finest of those voids, I think, was created by the single massive redwood-cased pillar that supported the massive main beam of the living room ceiling. You met it as you came from the rather dark entry hall into the large light living room, sunlit all afternoon. You were aware of the empty spaces around that pillar. You were aware of the movement of the air around it. Indeed, the house was rather drafty, but in California that doesn't much matter. You were aware of the clear, firm intention of the pillar itself. "The house depends on me," it said, "and I am dependable." The many windows and the several sets of French doors admitted the extraordinary light of the Bay Area, which combines inland sunshine with sea-reflected radiance. Each window had a view, either of pleasant Berkeley Gardens or, to south and west, the magnificent sweep of San Francisco Bay and its cities and bridges. Each window in itself was a pleasure, low-silled, but always tall enough to include the sky. A house so carefully and deliberately planned and intended to give pleasure has got to have an influence on a person living in it, and perhaps, most of all, on a child, because for a little child the house is pretty much the world. If that world has been deliberately made beautiful, a familiarity with and expectation of beauty on the human scale and in human terms may develop in the child. As Maybeck said, such daily experience will have the same power over the mind as music or poetry. But the experience of music or poetry is brief, occasional. To a child living in it, the experience of the presence of a house is permanent and inclusive. I fear I may seem to be describing a little princess growing up in a palace. That's not it. A palace may be beautiful or may not. Beauty's not its business. The business of a palace is to express power, wealth, importance. The modern McMansion is far more palatial in that sense than any Maybeck. When Maybeck built a palace, it wasn't for kings and princesses to live in, or as a statement of grandeur and wealth. It was to house and celebrate the public art display of a popular exposition. His buildings declare power only in the integrity and honesty of their design. The only purpose the Maybeck House might be said to share with a palace is the expression of order. When the relationship of everything in the structure around you is harmonious, when the relationships are vigorous, peaceful, and orderly, one may be led to believe that there is order in the world and that human beings can attain it. What I am circling around here is the very difficult question of the expression of moral feeling and the advancement of moral feeling through aesthetic means. Just growing up in a beautiful environment is not going to shape a child's mind favorably. The human social factor outweighs nature decisively. The extraordinary natural splendor of the Bay Area is probably not a very large factor in the development of kids growing up in poverty in the Oakland slums, though it may offer them some relief from decay and disorder. Even apart from social degradation and industrial ugliness, people who live way out in the country among lovely, varied scenery don't seem to have more breadth of soul or nobility of purpose than those who never saw anything in their life but dreary scrubland. For the beauty of nature as such to brighten and enlarge the mind, I think a child needs either an unusual gift of observation or a gradual training in observation and aesthetic perception that will deepen with maturity. There is evidence that young children kept in a single room or a narrow apartment arrive at school with stunted intellectual, spatial, and social skills, mentally handicapped by the physical and visual limitations of the space they grew in. It is hard to doubt that the cramped, ugly, filthy, noisy, disorganized surroundings of slums and poor barrios foster depression and anger in children who live in them, and limit and darken their perception of the world as a whole. All the same, their awareness of human interdependence and mutual responsibility may be far more intense than that of the middle-class child brought up with a room of her own. Neither natural beauty nor deliberately created beauty is enough to foster moral perception and discrimination. But I think it possible that early and continuous experience of aesthetic beauty may foster an expectation of order and harmony that may in turn lead to an active desire for moral clarity. I have trouble distinguishing the ethical from the aesthetic. Both my ethical and my aesthetic responses tend to be immediate to the point of suddenness, hesitant only in cases of real novelty or complexity, and stubborn, though capable of being educated and improved. They are so much alike that I am often uncertain whether I'm responding ethically or aesthetically. That's right, that's wrong. Such spontaneous certainty seems shallow, but it is not. It is deep and deeply irrational, rising from old, tangled, multitudinous roots, reaching down to the depths of me. As soon as I try to justify it, to find its reason, I'm in deep. When I ask myself why I think the Getty Museum in Seattle is wrong and why I think the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco is right, I am involved in the same immensely laborious, ultimately unsatisfactory processes as in explaining why I think abortion on demand is right or why I think torture is wrong. And I do not feel a real difference in kind, or even of importance, between the ethical and the aesthetic inquiry. But to pursue that statement further would require some understanding of philosophy, and I have none. I will not pursue abortion, torture, or Gary either, but will come back to the house I lived in. I think the house was built to an aesthetic ideal or concept which was indistinguishable from, or which I cannot distinguish from, a moral ideal or concept. Is it not fair to say that every building has a morality in this sense, and not merely a metaphorical one, in the honesty and integrity of its design and materials, or the dishonesty expressed in incompetence, incoherence, shoddiness, fakery, snobbery? I think I absorbed this morality of the building as I did the smell of redwood, or the sense of complex space. I think the moral conception of the building was as admirable as its aesthetic conception, from which it is, to me, inseparable. There is no beauty which hath not some strangeness in the proportion, Francis Bacon said, which may or may not be wholly true, but which is a useful idea. Our house had a great deal of strangeness in it. Does anybody play sardines anymore? For sardines, you have to have a large house, quite a lot of people, and darkness. One person is it. Everybody but it waits noisily in one room, long enough for it to find a hiding place somewhere else, under a bed, in the broom closet, in the bathtub, anywhere it pleases. Then the lights go off, and separately, in silence, everyone hunts for it. When you find it, you say nothing. You simply join it in the hiding place. If that's a broom closet, there may be room for quite a few. If it's under a bed, there are problems. One by one, other hunters find the site and squash themselves into the sardine can and suffocate giggles and try not to move until at last the final hunter finds them and they all burst free at once. It's a good game. Our house with its endless nooks and corners was a perfect sardines house. That would be a benevolent side of its largeness, darkness, and unexpected spaces. Another aspect was revealed to anybody staying alone in it at night. The first of our family to do so was a cousin of mine, who spent the night there before my father and mother moved in. He tried to sleep in the big bedroom at the top of the stairs. He leapt up because he quite clearly heard somebody coming up the stairs, step after step. He went to the top of the landing to challenge the intruder, but he could not see anybody at all. He went back to bed. More people climbed the stairs. People walked across the floor of the room towards him. Creak, creak, and still he could not see them. He ended up sleeping out on one of the balconies with the door shut, hoping the people would stay inside the house. Redwood floors have a kind of delayed resilience, compressed by a footfall. They snap back after a while. Hours, perhaps. Once you understand the phenomenon, it is more or less endurable. As an adolescent, I rather liked to hang over the deep well of the staircase and listen to the invisible people ascending it, or later, to lie in my small room and listen to myself walking around up in the attic, the floor repeating every step I had taken there that afternoon. But when I was a young child, the explanations were not very helpful to me. I slept then in the big bedroom at the top of the stairs, and the house, deep in the night, was scary. It was limitlessly large and deeply dark. There was room in it for many and mysterious beings. I had night terrors for years after seeing King Kong at age 6, but could handle them pretty well, so long as I knew people were in the house. The first time I was ever left alone in it, I went into a slow panic. I tried to be brave, but little by little the shadows and the creakings were too much for me. My older brothers were just across the street, and when I leaned from a window and wailed aloud, they came at once and were most comforting and remorseful. I wept apologetically, feeling very foolish. Why was I afraid of my own dear house? How could it have become so strange to me? It had a strangeness in it. That is, I think, the truth. Beauty is a very difficult word. I have already complained about not being able to approach it straight on. People don't use the word as freely as they used to, and many artists, painters, sculptors, photographers, architects, poets, reject it entirely. They deny that there is any common standard by which to judge it. They diminish it to mean prettiness and so righteously despise it, or they deliberately abandon it for truth or self-expression or edginess or other values they prize more highly. I don't pretend to be able to argue with such refusals of beauty when I can't even offer a generally acceptable definition of the word, but I think it behooves artists to consider what the word means to them, no matter what it means to others. How do they interpret the aesthetic component of what they do, its importance, its weight? What, besides that component, makes it appropriate to call their work art? What, besides the search to make something beautiful, makes an artist? There are perhaps as many answers to those questions now as there are artists, and nothing gives me the right to ask them of others. But I do feel the obligation to ask them of myself, and answer as honestly as I can. Novelists probably talk less than any other kind of artist about beauty, because the word is seldom used to describe what they make. As a novelist, however, I have always found it an important word in thinking about my work, and in describing that of other novelists. For instance, Pride and Prejudice is, to me, an absolutely beautiful work of art. If exquisite accuracy of language, perfection of proportion, of gait, of rhythm, in the service of powerful intelligence and insight and strong moral feeling, forming a complete and vital whole, if that isn't beautiful, what is? If that makes sense to you, you may be willing to let me use the word beauty in describing novels of very different kinds, such as Little Dorrit, War and Peace, To the Lighthouse, or The Lord of the Rings, or to think of novels which you'd be willing to call beautiful. Now, if Pride and Prejudice were a house, I think it would be a nobly proportioned, delightfully livable, not very large English house of the 18th century. I don't know what novel our Maybeck house could be compared to, but it would contain darkness and radiant light. Its beauty would arise from honest, bold, inventive construction, from geniality and generosity of spirit and mind, and would also have elements of fantasy and strangeness. Writing this, I wonder if much of my understanding of what a novel ought to be was taught to me, ultimately, by living in that house. If so, perhaps all my life I have been trying to rebuild it around me out of words.